You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked-about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host, and with me today is Dr. Charisse Hamblin, who was born and raised and educated in the Bronx, New York, where she attended the famed Bronx High School of Sciences. She also attended Franklin and Marshall College, which is also my alma mater. And during her years at Franklin and Marshall, she was very active on campus and served as vice president of the Black Student Union. She was also active overseas and spent time in Guadalajara, Mexico, serving citizens there. Dr. Hamblin graduated as a double major in biology and Spanish, and she went on to medical school at Northwestern University, where she completed her training in obstetrics and gynecology in Phoenix, Arizona. Dr. Hamblin works tirelessly in her Lancaster community and advises students and community organizers on various mentoring and exposure programs. She has a tremendous interest in helping young people learn more about possible opportunities in getting into medical school and medical training. And as you know, as I mentioned, she is herself a full-time board-certified OBGYN. Now, like most in her profession, she enjoys, but I'm sure she prefers not to do, surgery. But she gets to do operations on women to deliver wonderful, bouncing babies. And she also gets to care for women of all ages. And so we have her here with us today because of her keen interest, and particularly as an African-American physician, in finding pathways for people of color, and I would say other underserved communities, to find their way to careers in medicine. And she really is focusing on developing a pipeline that will grab interest in these young people, and making that pipeline, as we might say, less leaky. She's also created an organization called Patients Are Waiting. And I wanted her to talk specifically today about this because many people come to me saying that they want to start new organizations. And my immediate reaction to them is, well, there are already 1.3 million organizations out there. Why in the world would you want to create a new one? Well, in Dr. Hamblin's case, she had a really compelling reason to want to do that. And we'll let her talk specifically about why she started Patients Are Waiting. So I'm happy to have you with us today, Dr. Hamblin.
Thank you so much for having me, Art.
Well, Charisse, first of all, tell me how it was that you got this interest in medicine as a career.
I guess it's a funny story. I hated going to the doctor as a child. It was actually a very challenging endeavor for my parents to take me to the pediatrician, and they would bribe me and try to convince me that it would be okay. And I just knew that she was going to stab me with something and I would die. So I always wanted to be a teacher, and I hated going to the doctor for any reason. I hated the sight of blood. And in ninth grade, I took biology. Every day, my family would eat dinner together. And at the dinner table, my father would ask, well, what did you learn in school today? My report often had to do with my biology class. And to my explanations of what was happening in the body and what we learned about, his response was, okay, you like biology? Well, then you can be a doctor. I believed him because I'm a daddy's girl and I believe what my father says. And I went on through high school with that premise that I would become a doctor. And a part of my decision of where I went to school or college had to do with that. It's just, well, where could I go that I was going to be able to become a doctor?
That's really interesting, especially the part about not wanting to get needles. I can remember when my daughter was very young, I got a call from my wife saying that I got your daughter on the bus, and she immediately started crying. And I said, why did she start crying? She said, because she knew from the bus we were taking, she's about 3 years old at the time, she knew from the bus we got on that she was going to the doctor to get a needle. So that's, I guess that's real among young people. But it's really fascinating to me that you took this interest in biology. So you must have just had an aptitude for it. Is that what you would say was the driving factor? You just saw something in it that just said, wow, this is what I want to do.
Well, I did well in school growing up. I was a smart kid and I had parents who were very involved and we were active. My parents said, look, it's your job to be a student. And so you have to go to school and you have to do your homework and you have to do your best. And so whatever things were available, that was part of what I did. Science in elementary school is just one of your classes. So I wasn't a part of any kind of like science program or anything like that. I did go to a magnet high school that was Bronx High School of Science. And that school, we were preparing for Regents exams. And so a lot of my science exposure really started there as far as science exposure beyond what is the normal coursework for an elementary school learner. And so biology class was interesting. And I just found learning about the body and how it works to be very fascinating. And I've always had a curiosity about how things worked. And so that was part of it. So we took biology, chemistry, physics, and then many AP courses were offered in my high school. And so I took 3 AP classes. APs are advanced placement. So in New York, you have this Regents curriculum, and not every high school uses it, but you have to take a standardized test at the end of the year to get your Regents credit for doing that course. So I think that when I reflect back now on the educational steps, having a high level of academic rigor in high school set me up for success in college. It's not enough to just do the courses. It's to push yourself, take the challenges that are available. And each time that I learned something or took a class, I wish I knew at that time that that could be the last time I got to learn that thing. Like now, as I talk to young learners, I reflect and tell them the things that I wish I knew way back when. So for example, you know, learning in global studies, I never did, you know, Model UN or something like that. And I didn't have an appreciation that unless I took those courses in college, I wouldn't have that understanding again.
Charisse, I'm asking these questions about your background because it would seem that as an African-American young woman and before as a young girl, you are somewhat of an anomaly in the medical profession. Obviously, that's something that you've seen. What was it like growing up being either the only one or one of a few pursuing a pathway toward medicine?
So it's interesting that you say that and that framing. And I think so much of the time that is the narrative that we're told this week. African-American women or Black women make up about 2% of the medical profession. I take that statistic not as I'm one of the chosen few, but to me, that is a conviction of the medical community for there to only be 2%. I think that for me, one of the factors that was different is the fact that I was always told that I could do it, that at home, most of the time at school and in my community, I was always encouraged. There were times that I was the only Black student in my class or the only Black female student in my class. But again, I had a very nurturing home and church environment. And so it never felt like an insurmountable experience. But there were definitely times you look around and you're like, wait, where are the rest of the Black people?
So I am really interested in knowing a bit more about not only how you became a doctor, but what now drives you to chart a pathway for other young people who might have an interest in medicine?
I'm very driven by the idea and the notion, like I know that I'm special. I'm special to my husband. I'm special to my family. And I was special to, you know, my parents. But I don't think that I'm so special that others can't do it. I meet wonderful, aspiring physicians every day. And I know that what helped propel me was people around me saying, I believe in you. Yes, you can. Of course you can. And some stubborn resistance to the voices that said, are you sure that you want to do that? Don't you want to become a nurse? Are you sure that medicine is right for you? It takes a long time to get there. And so I'm really thankful for the values that I had that were basically like, look, I have my youth and I could be in school and keep going, or I can go to work sooner. Like, I'm not in a rush to go to work. Let me go ahead and stay in school and keep doing what I set out to do. And so what drives me to help other students is really that, you know, that there are so many people who didn't persist in medicine who would be great physicians and who would be great additions to the medical profession. And it makes me upset and it makes me sad to have fewer amazing colleagues or fewer physicians or treating people who are, they're someone's daughter, someone's aunt, and they need care that is compassionate, that is passionate about them the same way that they feel about themselves. So if you're treating a patient that you can see yourself in, you treat that patient differently. You spend more time with them. You joke around more with them. They share more with you. And I am really blessed to be able to have those types of patient interactions every day. And I want more patients to receive that kind of care and more doctors to have that same kind of experience.
So it would be safe to say that your interest in starting an organization to deal with this is really more focused on patients than it is physicians.
Absolutely. Art, you know, I tried not to start an organization. Over the years in my attending physician life, I've tried to work within other organizations to affect change in the face of medicine, in the landscape, and in the path of minority pre-med students. And over time, it just became really clear that the work of increasing diversity in medicine is going to take multiple efforts from multiple vantage points. The work that I can do as a mentor is really focused, but there is work that can be accomplished beyond the number of students that I can personally reach and say that patients are waiting for you. You do not have the luxury of self-doubt. It's not an option for you to listen to that voice that says, I'm not sure you can, or that dissuades you from the end goal, because people are dying. We see it in COVID. We can see the disparate outcomes in different states, whether it's with access to testing, whether it is with admission to the hospital once a patient is presenting to the emergency room with shortness of breath. We see it in transplant. We see it in every single aspect of medicine, disparities in care. And at the root of health disparities is not race, it is racism. And if we're going to dismantle systemic racism, systems have to change. I can play a small part in that. And the part where I have tried to apply pressure through the work of Patients Are Waiting is to assist the students at having success in their journeys and to build that armor against the challenges that they face, because there will always be challenges.
So let's focus a minute on the physician's pipeline. Right now, what would you say is the disparity in the number of African-American physicians compared to the number of people in the population?
So right now, African-American physicians are 5% of the total physician community. That 5% has been the same since the 1960s. And the place where I think that we are losing students is in undergraduate education. Many students are freshmen and will say that they're pre-med, sometimes up to 50% of an incoming freshman class. And we do see in the undergraduate experience the attrition or the drop-off of students changing their pathway from pre-med to something else is much higher for African-American students and other minority students. And of course, there's going to be some change as you take different classes and have different experiences. However, to go to a graduation of like single digits from such a high proportion of freshman year who express an interest in medicine or in a STEM field is just, we need to have students persist more in undergraduate.
So in undergraduate, what are some of the undergraduate programs that are succeeding and why are they succeeding? And what do some of the ones that maybe aren't succeeding need to do?
Like with many problems, there are multiple factors. But we do see, for example, Xavier University in Louisiana has been turning out 50 or more applicants to medical school, Black applicants to medical school every year. Now, Xavier is known for its pre-med curriculum and their success, but they're also a historically Black college. And so there's been a lot of talk about the role of HBCUs in many, many issues, and particularly in medicine and in this issue. But the proportion of colleges that are historically Black versus predominantly white institutions, you know, the bulk of the universities in the United States are predominantly white institutions. So what's different about these places? Well, there's differences in instruction, of course, but one of the things you don't worry about, if you're told at an HBCU, maybe you should consider something else, you know that the reason is not your race. But I think there are some things of best practices that can be applied. But again, as I said, it's multiple factors. And I don't think that we're spending enough time looking at where the leak is in that undergraduate experience.
So tell me about Patients Are Waiting. Charisse, tell our audience why you started the organization, some of the programs that it's engaging in now, and what are some of your aspirations for the organization?
Well, I started Patients Are Waiting informally in 2011, where I met students. I had come back to Lancaster and connected with the pre-med advisor and said, how can I help? You know, I had help from alums who helped to mentor me. How can I be of service to those who are coming behind me? And I wasn't specific. I wasn't specifically looking to help only minority students or only Black students or only students from New York. I just, you know, said, how can I help? And so over the years, we put things together and built mentorship programs. But what I found was I would go through organizing things and programs would be wonderful. And I'd look around and not meet any Black students. And then I would go to an African American Alumni Council event and meet Black students there who were pre-med. And there was some disconnect that was happening. So over the years, I tried to bridge that gap and make that connection. And that has turned into Patients Are Waiting. And so some of the things that we do as an organization, we held an annual Diversity in Medicine conference. That conference will be in its fifth year this September and has grown from a physician panel of six people to a three-day online and in-person conference where over 200 attendees got information and networking and connected with programs for graduate programs and medical schools. We have people who have attended our conference have been successful in their medical school applications. And we're celebrating some of those victories now in the coming months as people get their acceptance letters. Besides our annual conference, we also have community programs such as a doula program that helps to connect women in Lancaster with doulas to help address the disparity in maternity outcomes for Black and Latina women. And so many programs exist for students, and there are some things that are more community facing. And there's a continuum. As I said, the work of eliminating health disparities is going to take multiple fronts and multiple efforts from multiple perspectives. So as an organization, our focus is really on students. And then I am based in Lancaster, as is one of our other board members. And so the community work that we do is mostly focused on Lancaster.
Well, I hear from a lot of people, Charisse, who are either starting out their careers, maybe a third way in like you or further down in their careers, that they don't really have time to volunteer. They have families, they have a very demanding work schedule, and they can't seem to fit in volunteer work. But somehow you manage to do so much with your time. And I'm just curious what you would say to others and how you make it all work.
That's a great question. And sometimes I am doing well in one area and not so well in another. And, you know, there's a limit to time. But the best thing that I've found to create more time is when there's overlap. So as an OBGYN, there's work that I do on a daily basis that has to do with health disparities. And so there's work of patients are waiting that feeds and contributes to my work as an OBGYN. As a teacher of residents, there's work that Patients Are Waiting does with our community book club, where we're examining health disparities and opening conversations with people in medicine and outside of medicine. And that helps to feed my residents and help them to be better and helps me learn as well as them. And so the best way that I have been balancing things is really to look for the areas of overlap where one part of my life is coinciding or overlapping with another part, and really lean into those things, because I can't create time. I haven't figured that out yet.
Well, that is the ultimate challenge, isn't it? You can earn more money, but you can't make more time. So this is so much of the reason why we created this podcast. We want people to find ways to contribute with their own time and resources, whether that be money or just giving hope to people to continue on. So I'm really happy to hear you say that for you, it's been about finding ways to make that overlap, your career and your spare time. That's a strategy that I guess many people at this phase in their lives can consider when they're thinking about how to contribute to society. Because I do hear from a lot of young people who say they have this family, they have student loans that they're trying to pay back, and they can't find the time and resources because they claim they don't have it. And I want to hold you up because you're an example of what you can do. You have to be creative. You have to find ways to contribute. But you should also feel like you're getting something back from this. In your case, do you think that there's something that you get back from contributing your time and money the way you have?
Absolutely. I will say some of the most energizing experiences that I have in medicine are working with students. And probably part of what pushed me to do more with mentorship is just that every time that I talk to a group of students, it energizes me and it forces you to reflect. I think that you can be in your career and reach a point of stagnation or a point where you forget what it was like the first time you did something, or you forget that feeling that you had by acquiring a new skill or having a new accomplishment. And when students, sometimes the questions they ask could be so out there. This week, I talked to a group of middle schoolers and someone asked, you know, what was it like to deliver a baby? And the question just made me think about how many times, it does get old. Like I've delivered over 1,000 babies and it does get old, especially at 2 o'clock in the morning. But every now and again, it feels like the first time. And talking to students continues to give me that energy and that point of reflection. So it's been really rewarding. And then seeing people go from a feeling of, am I good enough? Am I worthy? And watching them stand up straight and flex and say, I have multiple acceptances. I'm going to be a doctor. And then even watching them cross from that feeling of uncertainty to then deciding on a specialty. It's a really wonderful progression to see. And I really feel honored to be a part of that with so many students' lives.
I remember talking with you about how your career transitioned from living in Arizona to now Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and what you found in that change. Was part of that this now desire to be more active in the community?
I think throughout my educational journey, I've been pretty active in the community. It's funny because sometimes you'll say, how will you connect with communities not like yours? Or how do you give to the underserved? And when I read those questions, I'm like, I am underserved. What do you? So from college and doing work with tutoring students to medical school and doing medical mission work and working in like the free clinic that was there at my medical school at Northwestern to, you know, residency where I trained in a county hospital, Maricopa Medical Center, and there was a jail in the hospital. And, you know, we took care of women regardless of insurance. And so I was seeing on one side of things, patients with lots of privilege, and on the other side of things, patients with absolutely nothing. So I think that the desire to give back and to do has been there all along, and it's just taken different forms depending on what part of my training I was in and what was available to me at the time.
So I want to go back to your parents, the beginning for you, because many guests have told me that their orientation toward giving sort of came from how they were raised and what they experienced with their parents. Was that true in your case, or would you say it also came from other places?
They're definitely my family, my parents. They were very giving. It's interesting. So I grew up in the Bronx. My parents are from Barbados. And so they came to the United States independent of each other and met in Brooklyn at some party. And then, you know, got together and started their family in the Bronx. And my mother was a nurse in the operating room at Albert Einstein Hospital. And my father was a carpenter by trade, a teacher by training, and then a maintenance worker by profession, by work. I grew up in the church and, you know, there was always community service things that we did. And I don't know that I made a conscious decision to give or to give back. And now when I talk to doctors and they're like, they have their family foundation or something like that, that is not a part of my heritage. But doing for others is a part of my heritage, is a part of my upbringing, and it's a part of my life now. It's always been a part of my life. You do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It's like you grow up and you learn this. And so whether it's holding a door open for somebody or sitting down and explaining something that you'd look with a face of bewilderment at something that was said, or helping a friend study for something, or taking somebody to the airport. I mean, these are just things that you do. So now in my professional life and in my, I think in my adulthood, I'm learning about structured giving and ways to set things up. But I have learned through living and through my upbringing, just the things that I think make people good people.
Very well said. And I'm grateful, and the rest of us in the world who know you are also grateful that you have this orientation. So if we had the chance to really address this problem of disparity in the health profession, what do you think we would accomplish as a society?
If we really got into it in earnest, and if the medical community and healthcare community reflected the community at large, I think we'd be a healthier country. We would have better health outcomes, or health outcomes that are aligned with our resources as a nation. And there's not any good reason why we are not living long and healthy lives and having the birth outcomes that other countries are experiencing. There's not a good reason for the health inequity that we see. And I think that diversifying the medical profession would have effects on healthcare outcomes. It would also have effects on economic outcomes in the groups that are underrepresented in medicine currently. So I think a lot can be accomplished.
What are some of the key barriers that we need to break down? And secondly, what do you see as low-hanging fruit in terms of what we can all do right now?
Right. Well, some of the key barriers, I think, are aligned with the way that we've organized our work with Patients Are Waiting. We talk about increasing the pipeline of minority clinicians. And so everyone knows a child or sees a child. And I think that as we're looking at children, we have to speak life into their dreams and tell them, yes, you can. Of course you can, you should. And that you can do anything that you want to do. Just keep at it. Keep working hard. I'm behind you. I'm with you. I support you. That is absolutely imperative. there are too many forces and too many places where children, especially Black and brown children, are being told, whether verbally or implicitly, that they have limitations, that there's a ceiling to what they can accomplish. And only if they're one of the chosen few or one of the special ones that they can do these great things. And we need to flip that on its head. Yes, you're special. Yes, you're smart. Yes, you're capable. The world is better because you're in it. I believe in you and I'm with you. How can I help? That goes so far. Secondly, making the pipeline less leaky is where we've put some of our work. And I explained that with, you know, an undergraduate, that same message that that child needed to hear, the undergraduate student who's committed to college and they're going through these 4 years needs to know that there is a place for them in the field of their choice, whether that's medicine, whether that's law. And it's not our job to be sorting out who is a good fit and who isn't. It's for that person, that learner, to decide their path. And so I think we need to pour into the undergraduate students, and whether it means supporting your alma mater, whether it means cooking a student a meal, whether it means telling that college student who's coming home for Thanksgiving, tell me about what you're doing and what are you excited about? How can I help you? How can I push you forward? And I think that's something that you can actually make an impact on, because those students are experiencing challenges, whether they recognize them as challenges or not. And the more positive and affirming messages that our learners in college are hearing, the more likely that they will be persistent. And each of us has an opportunity to stand in the gap for a student, for a learner. And if your propensity is to say, well, I want to have great care, or I want to help people become doctors, or I just want to help learners, there's lots of different ways to do that, to help in that undergraduate timeframe. And as far as low-hanging fruit, you know, we're not all involved in the healthcare or medical profession, but representation matters, and we each can do our part at making a way for someone else. And I think that if we take a look around, you know, the last year has been a year of awakenings for many organizations, institutions, and people. Last year was hard with the pandemic, and with so much civil unrest, social unrest, police killings, and there was an awakening overall that racism is still alive and well in the United States, and it's a challenge that we haven't overcome. And I think that this question of diversity in medicine, as well as in other fields, does touch us all. So the low-hanging fruit to me is for you to look around, and if there are places where you are and there's no people of color, ask yourself why and then bring it up. Because if we're not representing the people that we're serving, whether that's in healthcare, marketing, business, education, then there's going to be things that are missed because we are missing some of the perspective that can be brought by having diversity at the table in the decision making. There's a quote that really resonates with me, you know, that diversity without inclusion is just decoration. And so the low-hanging fruit is to look around, and if it's a homogenous room, if there's people that are missing, make sure that those people get invited and we make some changes to have various voices. And then when we invite those voices, that we actually include them in what we're doing, and listen to the contributions and amplify those voices, because everyone has a contribution to make. We can all make a difference in changing where we are as a country and where we head as a world.
Wonderful. So how can people help?
So for our patients are waiting, you can help from anywhere that you are. On our website, we have lots of opportunities to participate. Whether it's with our annual conference as an online participant, you don't have to be in this local area. Our work with students, there's opportunities to give and support our work that we are doing in Standing in the Gap for Students. There's our book club, which we have folks who participate from all over the country, and hopefully we'll get to where people are participating from all over the world. That's an opportunity to grow and learn together about some of the intersections where we are and how health equity can be accomplished from various perspectives. So there's lots of ways to get involved, and we'd love to have more people into the Patients Are Waiting community.
Charisse, I want to thank you for joining me tonight on this episode of the Heart of Giving podcast. I want to comment that I've always seen you as an advocate for young people. And I want to give you just a bit of caution that you may also be becoming a person who's focused on long-term institutional success as you build Patients Are Waiting. And that's not necessarily a warning. It's just an encouragement that we can actually do both. We can advocate and we can build organizations. And it's great to see you doing both.
Thank you.
I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in to this episode of the Heart of Giving podcast. I'm Art Taylor, and I hope you'll listen to our next episode. You can find us on all major podcast platforms.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. Send your comments and ideas to Nona@thusmarket.com. That's Nona@thusmarket.com. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.